Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The days are growing longer, the jasmine is in bloom, and across Louisiana, we're treasuring the gift of spring before heat, humidity, and hurricane season are upon us. On this week's show, Louisiana Eats is celebrating the tasty treats of springtime. With Derby Day approaching, we're polishing our silver cups for the perfect drink for this time of year, the mint julep. Legendary bartender and raconteur Chris McMillan joins us with a tribute to that sophisticated and refreshing cocktail. We then move from adult beverages to childhood sweets, specifically ice cream, but not the flavors you'll find in any grocery store. Jillian Duran of Rom House tells us how she uses her fine pastry making skills to create both ice creams and ice cream cakes like nothing you've ever seen before. And finally, spring marks the arrival of blueberry harvest season in the South. We travel to Poplarville, Mississippi, where Donald Van De Werken and Jeff Brown of JD Farms are preparing to reap some of the biggest, sweetest, best blueberries in the region. We're serving you a taste of spring on this week's Louisiana Eats. New Orleans bartender Chris McMillan is legendary in the mixology community for his understanding and love for classic cocktails. Imbibe magazine named him one of the top most influential cocktail personalities of the last century. And it's no wonder why. A cocktail historian, Chris is known for telling stories or reciting drink-themed poetry while serving up spirits. Order any classic drink from him at his bar and restaurant, Revel, and you'll understand. But if there's one cocktail that Chris is most closely associated with, it's the mint julep. In the early years of Louisiana Eats, Chris joined us for a timeless conversation about this quintessential springtime staple. Chris, would you walk us through the classic preparation of the julep?
Absolutely. You need just a couple of essential items, preferably a metal cup, silver if possible. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, a Collins-style glass that's thin, tall and thin, so it'll more efficiently radiate away the heat from the glass. You need some beautiful fresh mint, crushed ice, and a good bourbon. I take my metal glass, put a small quantity of simple syrup in the bottom of the glass, which is just a equal mixture of water and granulated sugar mixed and shaken together until dissolved. You don't have to heat it. It'll dissolve in a matter of seconds. That's why they call it simple. We put just a little bit in the bottom of the glass and then take a large handful of mint and squeeze it in your hand so that you just release those oils. And then drop it into the bottom of the glass, take a muddler, and just gently rub the mint against the sides of the glass, touching all of the surfaces. And the small amount of simple syrup we placed in there acts as an adhesive. So it holds the mint all over the interior of the glass, distributing the oil evenly. And then you fill it up with as much crushed ice as you can get into it, and even a couple of inches above the glass, making a tall cone like a snow cone. Because when you hit it with that room temperature alcohol, the volume of the ice is going to subside dramatically and rapidly. And so if you want it to be filled, you need to overfill it with ice. And then you just pour the simple syrup after having gotten the bourbon in there. Pour the simple syrup over it, and the sweetness is a matter of preference. The beauty of the drink is its simplicity, and it's about the bourbon, the mint, the sugar, and the ice, and nothing else.
What makes a drink a julep?
Julep was a Persian word, and it meant rose water. If we ever go to places like Mona's or Lebanon's Cafe, and we have their Lebanese iced tea, which is a rose water flavored tea, it's kind of the concept. It very early on comes to mean a flavored syrup, and those syrups were used in connection with medicinal compounds. And inherent in the word julep is a tonic effect. And you had different kinds of juleps dependent upon what tonic effect you were seeking. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, if you will. And by the beginning of the 19th century, julep takes on a dual role. You know, one as this medicinal tonic, and the other as a recreational beverage. And it maintains this dual meaning throughout the 19th century. Physicians commonly prescribed juleps. It was the first drink to popularize the use of ice in the U.S. Historically, what the martini was to the 20th century, the julep was to the 19th century as the quintessential American beverage.
I noticed that you don't stir a julep.
It would depend on who I was making for and the circumstances. The julep, there are very few drinks that have the quality of being multidimensional, that when you start it, it tastes one way. When you finish it, it tastes a different way. Because of the different densities of the ingredients, you have water from the ice, you have alcohol from the bourbon, you have sugar from the syrup. Each one of those things has a different weight. And so as the drink settles and as the drink dilutes, those flavors have different intensities at different levels. And so the deeper you get into it, the mintier it's going to become, the sweeter it's going to become. And, you know, I tell people when having their julep for the first time, when you first drink it, you're going to say, oh, my God, can I drink this? It's going to be the biggest, stiffest shot of bourbon you ever had. You know, but if you get to about right here, and that's about 2/3 of the way down the drink, it starts to have diluted and softened up a little bit, becomes a little mintier, a little bit sweeter. And by the time you get to the end of it, you're going to wish it'll never end. It's really a lovely thing.
Well, it sounds to me like all of those people who you see stirring madly in their silver cups, trying to get that icy outside, are really doing the drink inside an injustice.
If you want to make the exterior of the cup frost, it needs to be dry.
Ah.
If it's wet, it won't frost. But if it's dry, it will. And so that's really, it's a matter of technique and understanding of the process.
Would you elaborate for me on the different treatments of the mint and what you're doing and why?
Mint is a delicate herb. And your object is not to crush the herb, but to release the oil, the perfume of the mint itself. And that doesn't require extensive manipulation. I use probably 5 times the mint that most people use. And by using more mint, it requires less manipulation to produce more oil. If you over-extract the mint, all plants, the green is chlorophyll, which is bitter. And if you over-extract the mint, you will add bitter flavors to the drink. You can hide it in a mint julep under the robust, intense flavors of bourbon. But a mojito, on the contrast, same principle, is often ruined by bartenders who think they're demonstrating their skill to you by showing you their muddling technique. And by over-extracting the mint, they're releasing those bitter flavors. And instead of that delicate mint perfume and adding that into the drink, it destroys the drink. And, you know, I mean, its essence is rum, sugar, mint, club soda. Almost the same. In fact, you could even say that a mojito is probably influenced by the mint julep, you know, and an evolution of the Cuban expression of the mint julep within the context of their culture and their indigenous ingredients.
Why is the mint julep so closely tied to horse racing?
Well, it originally came from Virginia. All of what we now call Kentucky was once part of Bourbon County, Virginia. Kentuckians don't widely like to acknowledge this.
Okay.
But the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for horses, the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for the production of whiskey, is its natural geology. It's limestone, which is a natural occurring material. It's calcium that's decayed through the eons, and the water, the rain, filters through that calcium substrata. Well, I'm not a geologist, so I don't have the correct terms there, but it softens the water and makes it calcium rich. Calcium makes big, strong bones, which make for great horse races, that makes the bluegrass blue. And wherever you make whiskey, you must have large amounts of water and the right kind of it. So that's the reason why Scotland is also one of the great whiskey producing regions of the world, is because of its water.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for treating all of the Louisiana Eats audience to the classic mint julep.
Well, that's very sweet of you. It was my pleasure.
From 2012, that was master mixologist Chris McMillan speaking with us about the refreshing springtime treat, the mint julep. Before we move on, now we have a treat for you. While digging into our archives to bring you this interview, we came across audio from our conversation that has never made it to air until now. Here's Chris mixing up a mint julep for us in the studio while reciting a poem. This one is by Kentucky Colonel Joshua Sule Smith, published in the 1890s.
Then comes the zenith of man's pleasure. Then comes the julep, the mint julep. Who has not tasted one has lived in vain. The honey of Hymettus brought no such solace to the soul. The nectar of the gods is tame beside it. It is the very dream of drinks, the vision of sweet quaffings. The bourbon and the mint are lovers. In the same land they live, and on the same food are they fostered. The mint dips its infant leaf into the same stream that makes the bourbon what it is. The corn grows in the level lands through which the small streams meander. By the brookside, the mint grows. As little wavelets pass, they glide up to kiss the feet of the growing mint. It bends to salute them. Gracious and kind it is, living only for the sake of others. The crushing of it only makes its sweetness more apparent. Like a woman's heart, it gives its sweetest aroma when bruised. Among the first to greet the spring, it comes. Beside the gurgling brooks that make music in the pastures, it lives and thrives. When the bluegrass begins to shoot its gentle sprays towards the sun, mint comes, and its sweetest soul drinks at the crystal brook. It is virgin then, but soon it must be married to old bourbon. His great heart, his warmth of temperament, and that affinity no one understands demand the wedding. How shall it be? Take from the cold spring some water, pure as angels are, and mix it with sugar till it seems like oil. Then take a glass and pour your bourbon in it. Crush your mint with a spoon. Crush it around the borders of the glass and leave no place untouched. Then throw the mint away. It is a sacrifice. Fill with the cracked ice the glass and pour in the quantity of bourbon which you want. It trickles slowly through the ice. Let it have time to cool. No spoon is needed. No stirring allowed. Then place sprigs of mint around the brim so that the one who drinks may find a taste and an odor at one draft. When it is made, sip it slowly. August suns are shining. The breath of the south wind is upon you. It is fragrant, cold, and sweet. It is seductive. No maiden's kiss is tender or more refreshing. No maiden's touch could be more passionate. Sip it and dream. You cannot dream amiss. Sip it and dream. It is a dream itself. No other land gives such sweet solace for your cares. No other liquor soothes you so in melancholy days. Sip it and say, there is no solace for the soul, no tonic for the body, like old bourbon whiskey. Cheers to you.
And cheers to you, Chris. You can find the legendary Chris McMillan mixing drinks and sharing his knowledge at Revel in New Orleans Mid-City. To learn more, visit revelcafeandbar.com. Now that Chris McMillan has you all ready to make that mint julep, where's the mint going to come from? Stay tuned, and we'll help answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. From Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets tastes like home. And from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. Camellia's latest innovation makes life easy for today's smaller households. Beans for two. If a bag of beans is too big for your family, Camellia's New Orleans-style red beans for two and Cajun-style white beans for two has everything needed for dinner in today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Now that we've learned all about making mint juleps from master cocktailian Chris McMillan, just where is all that mint going to come from? If you're a resident of the South, it should come right from your own backyard. Mint is a perennial, which means once you plant it, it will come back time and time again. In fact, unless there's a hard freeze, your backyard mint is likely to stay productive year-round. First, find the best place for planting. Mint prefers partial shade and loves moist ground. Goodness knows, we've got a lot of that in Louisiana. You'll only need a couple of starters planted about 2 feet apart to quickly grow a full bed of mint. Mint can be invasive, setting out to conquer new territory with horizontal runners and underground rhizomes. In just a year, one little plant can turn into a sprawling 4-foot giant. The good news is, mint loves to be trimmed, and the best way to propagate more mint is simply to put the cuttings in water. In no time at all, roots will sprout, making more baby mint plants that you can share with all the neighbors. Mint makes for good neighbors, especially when the neighborhood gathers for one of your about-to-be-legendary mint juleps. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
I'm Jillian Duran, and I'm the owner and ice cream maker at Ram House Ice Cream.
Jillian Duran, a self-described art school dropout, found her true medium in food.
After the recession, I found myself working in a Mexican restaurant, and I kind of realized, like, I love this. And then I started baking a lot and realizing that it took two things that I love, chemistry and art, and kind of combined them.
After a stint in cooking school, she eventually found herself working at the revered Blue Hill at Stone Barns in New York, and Public, a Michelin-rated Manhattan hotspot.
Fine dining, plated desserts was really kind of where I found my niche. Originally, cake design and decoration that really appealed to me in school, but I quickly was immersed in this like huge environment where there's so many different facets of what you can do in culinary, not just cooking and not just baking, and to really be a pastry chef and to understand plated dessert not only through the composition of flavors but also the composition of color and what it looks like aesthetically, but most importantly is to also make it taste good. You don't want to deliver on one and then fall through on the other.
Jillian uses all her skills to create a perfect dessert, requiring a careful composition of flavors and colors, something she last did at the restaurant Maypop in New Orleans. When Maypop's chef, Michael Galata, closed down during the pandemic, Jillian realized her dreams of owning her own business. Opening Rom House Ice Cream inside Courtyard Brewery in the Garden District, her business was an instant hit with locals. In March of last year, Jillian put Rom House on a short hiatus before returning full-time as a pop-up. Take one look at her Rom House Instagram to see Jillian's edible art on display. Jillian, your ice cream is delicious.
Thank you.
As much as I'm desperately trying to put that pandemic in my rearview mirror, a lot of people would have regarded what happened as an adversity, but you turned it into an opportunity. You didn't have a job.
I didn't have a job. I was just promoted to pastry sous chef, and so I thought, great, I'm going to have this salary. I had a summer position that I've held for the past couple years as a private chef on Long Island. Both of those jobs fell through, so I instantly had no income. And then I kind of left New Orleans for a little bit because I was also houseless. And I didn't want to go home to New York because my mother was just scared at that time. The pandemic, the numbers there were really bad and no one knew what was going on. It was new. And so I kind of sought refuge with the only family I have in the South, which is in North Carolina. And I stayed there for 2 months until I received unemployment and then eventually made my way back to New Orleans, got an apartment, got myself settled. And once I was done nesting, I was thinking about the future and the future of my place in the city and the future of the food industry in the city. And I kept seeing people closing and I just wanted to build something for myself so that I didn't need to rely on an existing system that seemed to be very broken at the time.
How did unemployment turn into ice cream?
I was fortunate enough to receive New York State unemployment because I'm a part-time resident of both Louisiana and New York. So for the past 4 years, I think I've been paying taxes in both places because of the summer unemployment. It was more money than I've ever made in my life. And I just thought, okay, here's my one shot. Like, here's some money that I can finally put towards something for myself.
And you settled on ice cream.
Yeah, I decided on ice cream. I got the LLC started. I did the Instagram, like, without actually even making anything. I was like, I need to get all my ducks in a row. And I reached out to friends who work in the food and service industry in social media to say, like, how do I put this out there? How should this brand look? Like, how do I do this? And they kind of pointed me in the right direction. And then I just made ice cream. I have this little machine at my house that spins about 2 quarts at a time. It takes 45 minutes. It's very slow, but great for a home cook. And I've used it many times. And I just was handwriting pints and I just made up these little menus and like typed them up and then posted on our Instagram, like, here you go, free delivery, like we're making ice cream. And I just followed all of my friends, all of my boyfriend's friends, and anyone who was actively also trying to do the same thing in New Orleans. And it just spread like fire. And once I kind of got things rolling, I kind of had this like, what am I doing? How am I actually going to do this? And I reached out to Chef Mike and said, hey, you have an empty restaurant. Like, can I use the ice cream machine? And he told me yes. And He told me not only could I use the restaurant, but he would buy the ice cream from me and I didn't have to pay him rent. And I thought, like, wow, this is incredible and way too nice.
So why did you name your business Rom House?
Originally, I wanted to call it Bricks House. Bricks meaning like sugar content.
B-R-I-X.
Yes. And house just because it was German and, you know, it's like kind of metal. And then I thought that word's been really played out. I know a lot of places that are called Bricks, and I thought it might be too obscure or abstract for some people, like who are not in baking or, you know about refractometers. And so I had a discussion with a good friend of mine, and he just said, what about ROM? And I was like, what? And he's like, it means cream. And I was like, yes, ROM House. Like, and I instantly saw the logo. I instantly was like, it fits my aesthetic, this like all black kind of metal, you know, kind of thing going on. And it just took off.
Is that your mascot on the label?
So yeah, our logo is an interpretation of Rom House, what it sounds like in English. So it sounds like Ram House. And so it's a ram, looks kind of like a goat, but he's supposed to be a ram and he has ice cream horns. And then he has like a little cherry on top and sprinkles and whipped cream with a little kind of drooling tongue. And above his head, you'll notice a crescent. And that's for New Orleans, for the Crescent City.
So you're in the pint business.
I'm in the pint business.
So back at the start, how many were you doing?
Oh, my gosh. I had one freezer that I bought off Facebook Marketplace. And I think maybe like 50 tops on like a good week. And that was hectic because I was doing all the sourcing, the production, delivering all of these things, like trying to put it out there. And then also taking all of the orders manually, like over the phone. And so it was a 24/7 job.
And what was that first menu like?
Oh my gosh. It was South Carolina peach ice cream. It was the curried corn with blueberry jam.
Curried corn?
Yeah. That's a flavor profile from Blue Hill at Stone Barns. It's a Mignardi that they used to do. And I was like, no, that's good. Like, I want to do that at ice cream. Honestly, I kind of was just inspired by what I had around me. I just started going to farmers markets around and buying things, which is still what I do. And I don't have a plan. I just kind of grab these ingredients, ask the people who are there what's good, and then I buy them, and then figure it out.
Well, that is the most incredible talent that you have because of your flavor combinations.
Thank you.
They're brilliant. So take us on a flight of Rom House flavor.
So I would say we've grown quite a classic kind of Rom House like grouping, right? Like our mainstays, even though we release a different menu every week. I would say my favorite is the black garlic and honey, which is called the black and gold, of course. Black garlic is insane, and it's so rich and deep in flavor, and it's black because it is cured, like almost fermented at low heat for about 6 weeks. It causes like a Maillard reaction, which is the caramelization of all the sugars in the garlic, and so that really mellows out that like acid, pungent kind of thing, and you end up with like just a rich caramel taste, and it's incredible and complex, and I use that a lot in a lot of things.
I tasted it and it is so good. It's really delicious.
Thank you.
And what else? What other flavors?
So we do an umami milk chocolate. That's a play on like French fries and Frosties, which is like my favorite thing as a child. It is a milk chocolate ice cream, and then it has furu, which is fermented tofu, like bean curd. We use that a lot in a Chinese restaurant that I worked at in New York, and I loved the flavor that it brings to things, this like salt, almost yeasty kind of like warm bread kind of flavor. And so that with the milk chocolate is like phenomenal. It's very light, but it's there. Thai tea and Oreos, huge. Huge flavor. It was just supposed to be a play on cookies and cream. And I thought, like, how can I make this more interesting? And I was like, I love Thai tea, love Oreos. Okay, we put them together. People freaked out. So that's, you know, often on our menu.
Wow. And so what has the reaction been?
It's been fairly positive. And I love that people often don't know how to pronounce some of the ingredients because I don't shy away from them. Like, I'll just call it, you know, Dobashan dark chocolate. And then people are like, what is that? And then I kind of like that it's like, oh, it's this thing. And you just ate beans and ice cream. And people are like, oh, that's actually really good. And so I think it's fun to be sharing ingredients with people that they haven't had, you know, a chance to try anywhere else. And then hopefully they go out to the store and they buy it and they make something with it.
I love the way you think and I love the way you create. What are some of the exciting things that you just haven't had a chance to make yet? What are you looking forward to?
Everything. I mean, the possibilities with ice cream are endless. That's kind of our idea, like an exploration of ice cream as a medium meaning like a vessel. Like, this is a great way to explore different flavor combinations. Ice cream typically has a high sugar and fat content, so that allows us to kind of just like pump it full of other things and really explore what ice cream should be now. You know, mint chip is good, of course it's good, but like, let's do something else. Ice cream sandwiches, that's a huge thing for me. We've done it in the past. The production on that is a lot. But yeah, I'm looking forward to doing like a bunch of different ice cream sandwiches and chip witches. Those are huge for me. Those are like one of my favorite.
What's that?
It's just a chocolate chip cookie with ice cream, usually rolled in sprinkles or chocolate chips. And we've done a play on it in the past. And I'd like to start offering that regularly, but we'll get there.
Well, bravo. I am so tickled that ice cream caused our paths to cross.
Yes.
And I just can't wait for my next scoop.
So, yeah, come see us.
Thank you, Jillian.
Thank you.
That was Jillian Duran of Rom House Ice Cream. She's popping up again at Courtyard Brewery Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, with more exciting plans coming up starting Memorial Day weekend. To learn more, follow Rom House on Instagram or drool at length online at romhouseicecream.com. Coming up next, we travel to J.D. Farms in Poplarville, Mississippi. There, Donald DeWorken and Jeff Brown are preparing to harvest some of the biggest, sweetest, best blueberries in the region. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, the beloved secret ingredient of Louisiana kitchens for over 90 years, made with just oil, vinegar, and egg yolks. Now Blue Plate is dressing up seafood feasts with a new creamy cocktail sauce. Enhanced with bold horseradish and a secret blend of spices, you just dip, savor, and say, ah. And for a touch of Creole charm, Blue Plate's Creole tartar sauce, complete with pickles, aromatic herbs, and a touch of Creole mustard, all together in that classic mayo base. Blue Plate mayonnaise, it's the good stuff. And from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this spring. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom and pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape, just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter. Donald Vandewerken and Jeff Brown have been in the blueberry business since 2004 when they founded J.D. Farms in the small town of Poplarville, Mississippi. Taking advantage of the region's acidic soil, perfect for cultivating blueberries, they soon became regular vendors at the Crescent City Farmers Market, selling two products, fresh blueberries and frozen blueberries. Since then, their output has grown dramatically. For one, Jeff and Don expanded their farm to cultivate tea. But when it comes to blueberries, today, in addition to blueberries by the pint, they sell all manner of blueberry products, ranging from juice, tea, and coffee to popsicles, jams, and jellies. The Louisiana Eats crew paid a visit to Don and Jeff's farm one hot and humid June morning. The two farmers joined us outside their blueberry fields, which they were in the process of harvesting. From where we stood, the towering bushes obscured the horizon.
Hi, I'm Jeff Brown, the J of J.D. Farms.
I'm Don Vandewerken, the D in J&D Farms. This is Charlie. We are in Poplarville, Mississippi, the capital of blueberries from Mississippi, and one of the leading states in the Mid-South for the production of blueberries. Just like in Ponchatoula for strawberries, this region, the soil and the microclimate make it conducive for blueberries.
So how big is your blueberry operation?
This farm here has approximately 16 acres of blueberries. The farm is a total of 48 acres here, but we also custom harvest another 20 acres down the road.
What's the yield from your acreage?
Typically, we can get anywhere from 1,500 to about 2,000 pounds per acre when we're being very conservative. On some varieties, we can go as high as 3,000 pounds per acre. So if you're looking at our fields now, we're standing in the fields, we have several different varieties of blueberries. What we grow here are rabbit eye varieties. And these are all mainstay varieties for the area. I'll also point out that maybe 10 miles down the road here is the USDA Blueberry Research Center, where all the subtropical or tempered climate blueberry research goes on. There, they came up a variety called Biloxi. And the reason why we have blueberries year-round is because of that variety developed right here. We can't really grow it here because of it's mostly a high desert. But when you're getting blueberries in December and January, it's because of the research that was done right here in Poplarville, Mississippi.
And then where are those berries coming from?
Peru, Mexico, Morocco, Argentina.
And they're growing that Biloxi variety?
Mm-hmm. And they continue to do research on new strains, new varieties for our area and for other folks too.
You know, I'm a city girl who never even saw a blueberry bush before. I'm ashamed to say. They're beautiful and they're taller and bigger and I think older maybe than I anticipated. Would you show me the ins and outs of blueberry picking?
Sure. So here you see one of our plants. This is probably one of our Premier or our Climax, which is one of our standard blueberry plants in this area of Mississippi. So you see this is all blue. So you would just roll this on your hand and you can drop it, let it drop down into the bucket. Then you see something that's over here that's also blue, but then you see a pink. So you're going to be careful about how you pick this one because you don't want that non-ripened fruit to roll down. So you very carefully pick those around that one, as opposed to, if you just do this and pull it down, of course the unripened fruit's going to fall down too. See, that one just bumped.
And you can notice all the berries that hit the ground from the rain and the storm, and it's unfortunate, but that's part of the whole process, you know. The fields are a little messy right now because we're harvesting, but normally, you know, everybody asks me, what's it like running a blueberry farm? It's almost like running a golf course. You want to keep the grass really cut short, and we spent a lot of money on cutting grass here.
Take us through how your season goes.
Well, typically our harvest crop is usually maybe 7 to 8 weeks long, but generally speaking, you start as soon as you harvest for the next year. So by July 4th, all the bushes you see here, you commented how tall they are, they'll all be trimmed to about 3 to 4 feet.
Right now they must be 5 feet or a little better, because
right.
Many of them are over my head.
Yeah, you can see the new growth there, and we want to get that off. And the reason why we want to get the new growth off is for next year's crop. So by July 4th, we'll bring in machinery and we'll trim all these bushes. But for right now, the way we harvest berries, we harvest with a machine, and the machine you're standing in front of here, it's called a Latal harvester.
Dude, that's incredible. Standing at 2 stories tall, the Latal harvester is a wheeled platform that has enough height to straddle a row of blueberry bushes. As it moves, the machine shakes the bushes, sorts the berries, and delivers them to the crew. Configured correctly, it can cover a lot of acreage in a short time, eliminating the need for hand picking altogether.
Technology in agriculture is amazing, and you know, there's no way we can harvest as much as we do without the machine. Years ago, we used to hand pick, but labor is very expensive, so you still have to have a 3 or 4 man crew on top. You know, we've been here 20 years, and we've probably had every neighborhood kid work at the blueberry farm. This, some of them, is their very first job. So after we harvest the berries, we go into the packing shed for final processing.
Don and Jeff led us past the picking machine and other farm gear to a garage, and finally, a large processing center.
Charlie, you can't come in. Charlie, come on.
The indoor space was cool and filled with empty plastic lugs, the 20 to 30 pound containers used to transport the blueberries. In the center of the room sat equipment for processing, sorting, and conveying their growing harvest.
So the berries, as we were talking about, get picked by the picker and then are brought in. And usually, depending on how much humidity there is in the air, we'll cool them here. And then we'll process them. And this machine you see in front of you is an air blower, and it blows the leaves and the sticks out of it. And then we have a soft machine here that pushes out the softs. Then we have a group of usually young teenagers, their first job, sit here, and they call it sorting the berries, pulling out the reds and greens or softs, whatever. Then we put it back in the lugs, and then we look at what our future orders are, our anticipated orders, and then we either put them in pints or the little clamshells you're used to seeing in grocery stores, or we put them in the green containers, which we are known for in the farmers market, in the Crescent City Farmers Market. We also do other things in here to kind of push berries. We have frozen bags, we freeze berries, and that's what you kind of hear in the background over there. We have several lugs of frozen berries, and we'll take that and put it into frozen bags. And then we also, I think, 2 years ago, we started juicing. So we take berries and we have a juice press over there, which we're about to expand again, where we basically press the berries and we sell blueberry juice, blueberry lemonade.
Let's see, we got dried berries, we got jam, we've got popsicles, we've got pies, we've got muffins. It goes on and on and on. During blueberry season, do you all ever rest?
We dream in blue.
Yeah. So. Well, it's. We always say that how many years have you been growing blueberries? And we say it's been 20 separate years. It's never the same. It's always a different challenge. Weather, employees, insects, fungus, disease, etc. Hurricanes, pandemics, economic crisis, you know, so we've always managed. And that's, I think, the important part here is staying to your base and, you know, giving the locals what they want. And if you're an entrepreneur or if you're a small business person and you want to start your own business in the food business, get into the farmer market. They will be honest with you. Now, trust me, we have tried other things and it's been a complete disaster, but we didn't have so much invested. We didn't have a storefront. We didn't have a lot of employees, but you had customers at a farmer's market and they come in and they tell you, and just like our coffee success, they're telling us, oh, it should need this or it needs that, or you didn't do this right. And so it's a great test market for younger people. You know, our little farm here, we have $1 million invested in this. And between the tractor, the equipment, the infrastructure, the plumbing, the sewer. And in fact, we were talking to some of the other farmers too, you know, it's just not throwing seeds in the ground and watching it grow. There's a lot of other infrastructure you got to have. It's not for the faint-hearted. That's why you don't see people jumping into it. But over time, we've conquered little battles and, you know, every day is a different challenge. And for me personally, I mean, how I kind of deal with it, you know, because it can get very stressful. In agriculture, there's a lot of stress. I watch a lot of YouTube and I watch all the other farms out there. And I always think I had a bad day or I work hard. You just can't imagine what some of these other farms are doing.
It's farmer therapy for us because we see that, because every day is different based on the weather, what you're dealing with, what type of production you're doing. And so we watch these YouTube videos and we see that they're all their issues. And we say, okay, I feel a little bit better about how my day went today. So
it's just absolutely just amazing. And a lot of them are young people. It gives me encouragement that other young people are going to get into it.
Donald van de Werken and Jeff Brown speaking to us on their blueberry farm in Poplarville, Mississippi. Blueberry season is coming up soon, so keep an eye out for Don and Jeff at the Crescent City Farmers Markets. To learn more about their operation, visit JD Farms on Facebook and Instagram. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. We'd like to welcome our new major sponsor, Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo. That's the good stuff. And big thanks to our returning flagship sponsor, Dickie Brennan and Company. Happy Hour is back, Tuesday through Friday, 4 till 6 p.m. at the Black Duck Bar, upstairs at Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe on Canal Street. With live music, a new oyster bar featuring crudo and other cold seafood selections, and as always, the largest rum selection in the South. Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner Tuesday through Sunday weekly with jazz brunch on weekends. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans, celebrating their innovative new product, Beans for Two. Camellia's new Red Beans for Two and White Beans for Two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans, scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. All handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.